They will regulate a militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Good Monday to you. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Buried Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. It is fantastic to have you with us today. I'm excited. Today is the day that my county in Virginia votes on a Second Amendment Sanctuary County resolution. I will be at that meeting this evening, and we will have full reports for you on tomorrow's Buried Arms Cam and Company. One of eight counties in Virginia that, if I'm doing my math correctly, scheduled to vote on this issue. There are some counties where apparently discussion is scheduled to happen. I don't know if a vote's going to be taken, but according to the Virginia Citizens Defense League, as of Monday, December the 9th, we are, at least as of like 8 a.m., up to 46 Second Amendment sanctuary communities in Virginia. The vast majority of those are counties. If I'm doing my math correctly, I believe we're at 44 counties in two cities. There are 95 counties in the state of Virginia. So by the time tonight ends and Tuesday begins, we could see more than half the state now having adopted Second Amendment sanctuary county resolutions. All right, took a perusal of the Supreme Court's website this morning to take a look at the orders that were released from Friday's conference. And we did not see any Second Amendment case listed in the orders. That's important. It doesn't necessarily mean that the Supreme Court is going to hear and rule on the New York City gun case, but we know that there are a number of Second Amendment cases that are queued up in conference, and the thinking is that if the court does moot that New York City case, that it's going to take up another Second Amendment case, going to pluck one of those other cases very quickly. So we didn't see that happen based on Friday's conference and Monday's orders. No new cases were listed. Now, I had the opportunity last week to speak with Chuck Michel, president of the California Rifle and Pistol Association, Second Amendment attorney. And we got into a number of these potential cases that are out there for the Supreme Court to pick up if, in fact, the court does moot the New York City case. Chuck was there at the Supreme Court during oral arguments for New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City. He joined us to talk about that and a whole lot of other options for the court when it comes to protecting our right to keep and bear arms. Take a look and a listen. Hey, Chuck, it is so good talking with you today. Thanks so much for coming to the program.
Always a pleasure, Cam.
I always appreciate your insight. I know you were actually at the Supreme Court for oral arguments in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City. We may be waiting a while, I guess, to find out what the court does with that case. Although if they do decide, Chuck, that this case is moot, and I hope that they don't, but if they do, do you think that we'll learn that before June of 2020, which is when, you know, kind of folks kind of expect that an actual opinion would be handed down?
Yeah, that's possible. That's very possible. It's not possible to say exactly how they may process this case, because there are several ways they could do it. They could conceivably, if five justices say it's moot, they could conceivably issue a one line order that says that the case is remanded as moot. There's no opinion. There's no analysis. There's no addressing the Second Amendment at all. It doesn't necessarily have to be done through some kind of a long written out opinion. Or they could decide that it's issue a mootness opinion, which if they are going to do that, that does not need to wait till the end of the court session in June. Typically they hold over all their most significant cases for the last few days of the court session, which runs from October to June. But mootness is not going to be considered it's not like gay marriage or the Second Amendment. It's just a procedural decision which could come out sooner. If it does come out sooner, either as a long opinion or just a short ruling, then the thing we're going to need to watch out for is whether they take one of the other cases that are pending in the Supreme Court that have been sort of sitting there for a while. The New York City case was moving through the system.
Well, and before we get into some of those specific cases, is it possible that the court before we know what they're going to do, could they kind of tip their hand a little bit? Could they agree to take one of these cases? Could all of a sudden we see it, you know, the Friday conference, when the orders come out that following Monday, even before they made any decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, is it possible that we could see the court say, all right, we're going to now hear Rogers versus Grewal or one of these other cases?
Yes, it's absolutely possible. I'm sorry, I just triggered something as I was trying to look up the cases for the Supreme Court.
I hate those autoplays on the websites, I know.
They might, if they do accept, I would think that if they can't keep the New York City case alive,
mm-hmm.
if there's the votes to declare it moot, then they will probably take one of the other cases that are pending, and they might very well take it immediately. They could grant cert. In fact, that would make sense if they see this coming, to grant cert so that they could conceivably have it briefed, more quickly. And I don't know if they could get it done by June, an oral argument before June, but I think it's possible. So they could accept the case and then rule on the mootness of the New York case later. That's why I say there's a number of different permutations that this could go through to
right.
Ultimately. But the good thing is, sooner or later, and I mean sooner, I think the Supreme Court is going to take, if it doesn't rule on the substantive Second Amendment issues in the New York City case, it's going to take one of these other cases and rule on those issues there. Because you can just tell that at least four members and probably five,
mm-hmm.
because I saw Roberts at Heller and McDonald, I know where he was thinking, they're chomping at the bit to issue a Second Amendment ruling, because frankly, the mandates that were set out in Heller and McDonald have been ignored by the lower courts. The lower courts have been thumbing their nose at the Supreme Court, and generally, judges on the Supreme Court don't appreciate that.
Absolutely, and that's one reason why I still think, you know, I saw the news stories that came out saying, oh, it looks like Justice Roberts isn't likely to go along with this. It looks like he was leaning towards mootness. I don't know that you can read that much into the three or four questions that Chief Justice Roberts asked, given that I think one of the questions that Ruth Bader Ginsburg asked, seemed to imply that she may come down on the side of the plaintiffs in this case, because she wondered, well, what about, you know, this requirement that you have to own a second handgun at your second home? You can't take your guns back and forth. I don't know how much you can really read into the questioning by these justices. But one thing that struck me, Chuck, is that, you know, if the court does decide, okay, this case is now moot because New York City amended its law after the Supreme Court agreed to review it, it's almost, I worry that sets up a rubber stamp of approval by the court for this to become a new strategy for gun control advocates, that, they'll keep these unconstitutional laws on the books. They'll defend them at the lower court level, at the appeals court level. But if the Supreme Court ever agrees to hear a case, they'll then tweak that law, even if there are still other unconstitutional issues that arise, as with the case of this amended New York City law, where there were a lot of questions about this continuous and uninterrupted language. And the attorney for New York City said, well, okay, so yeah, there may be some constitutional issues there, but they're new issues. That's going to require a whole new lawsuit. And that, to me, seems to be another form of gaming the system that gun control advocates can use to avoid this judicial review by the Supreme Court, which they've been desperately trying to do ever since the McDonald decision came down.
Well, and that's exactly what the District of Columbia did when they got a bad ruling on the right to carry, policy was struck down, and rather than appeal it to the Supreme Court because they didn't want to risk a bad decision, they just let the ruling against them stand. So yeah, they're desperately trying to dodge getting a case to the Supreme Court, and repealing the ordinance that's challenged once the Supreme Court takes the case is a strategy. It's not new. It's been tried in other gambits before. That's why this whole mootness issue is being taken seriously and being seriously discussed. It was the focus of the oral argument as opposed to focusing on Second Amendment issues. It was all about mootness.
Yeah.
But that's one of the... This really illustrates an excellent point here. Second Amendment litigation is not a world for amateurs, for people. I mean, I know there's a lot of well-intentioned people out there who want to push this issue, and there's a lot of lawyers, frankly, who just, they want to get to the show, you know, the Supreme Court. That's kind of every lawyer's dream. But if you listen to that argument, if you read that transcript, you listen to that argument, you can see how they were picking at the way the case was pled in the complaint originally.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't cover all those things initially, that's what can come back and bite you down the road. So they were arguing whether or not, did they ever make a claim for damages in the original complaint? Did they ever actually say they wanted to be able to carry the firearm to a cop? I mean, I've learned enough over the years from litigating, you know, before the Second Amendment was even decided in Heller and McDonald, we had to litigate on different legal theories, and there was always contest over standing, legal standing, and so I have become so cautious. I need, you know, I would have probably had a New Jersey range as a plaintiff in this case, saying we want these customers to be able to come to us. And, you know, I just, you can't be too careful in the way you plead a case, and unfortunately, unless you've had the experience of having your teeth kicked out a few times, people don't realize how careful they need to be, and they think they can mail it in, and then you wind up getting your clock cleaned at some point as the case moves up through the system.
Well, we even saw this a little bit in Peruta. Not that you got your clock cleaned, but when that case challenging the good cause requirements in San Diego County was filed to carry a concealed firearm, it was theoretically possible for an individual to carry openly an unloaded firearm, right? And so the trial court judge said, well, now the policies in San Diego are fine because you can openly carry your firearm. Then the state of California changes the law, bans the open carrying of unloaded firearms, but that's after this lawsuit was filed. That sort of changed the scope and the landscape of that case, but the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, you know, the challenge was really just about carrying a concealed firearm, and we don't think that that's a right under the Second Amendment. I mean, we've seen, as you say, it's not just even the attorneys, but the courts look for those, especially anti-gun justices, right? They look for those opportunities to, you know, grab a thread and then pull it, and then boom, all of a sudden the case disappears.
Right. Look, the courts do this for a living. Surprise, surprise. They know how to pick and choose the facts and apply the law in the way that gets them to the result that they want to get to. They can get, these justices can get a case to come out any way they want. Typically, they don't care enough in a pure commercial case where it's just money at stake. But when it's a policy decision or a constitutional right or something, you know, where there's bias involved like this, it's very easy to focus on something that really isn't the issue. That's why you have to try and anticipate. This is the biggest lesson. You have to try and anticipate how a judge is going to try and rule against you, how they're going to twist things or turn things or look at things to try and rule against you. There's a lot of people out there and a lot of very smart lawyers who academically can see that, you know, when you think things through correctly, you know, you go from A to B to C. But if you don't anticipate how you could be distracted or your argument could be derailed, then you're not doing the job. And that's why a lot of the lawyers that have kind of jumped on the litigation bandwagon post-Heller and McDonald have gotten nowhere, or worse, they get bad rulings. And if you don't get a court that will actually be loyal to logic, so to speak, and there's no such thing when you're talking about courts and reasonableness tests and, you know, tests that are just inherently subject to bias, it's easy to lose. It's not easy to win.
Yeah.
It's a heavy lift to do a Second Amendment case, right?
So let's talk about some of these cases that the court could take up if New York City a case gets mooted or dismissed. Because, as you said, there are several that they're currently holding on to in conference right now, right?
Yeah, it looks like there's actually 9, 10, 11. There's like about a dozen.
Wow.
Here's some bad news for you. If you want to see what Bloomberg is trying to do to us, go to the Duke Center for Firearms Law that's been set up at Duke University. This is where they are building the scholarship in anticipation of a ruling that changes the standard of review to a text history and tradition analysis,
mm-hmm.
which is different from the classic levels of scrutiny in a First Amendment case: reasonable basis, intermediate scrutiny, strict scrutiny. It will be based on, and this is where Paul Clement, these are the first words out of Paul Clement's mouth in front of the Supreme Court on Monday. If they change the test, then there's going to be a lot of decisions made based on what laws existed in the past, what gun control laws existed in the past. And so Bloomberg's lawyers have already figured this out. They've already set up this Center for Firearms Law, where they are documenting all the historical gun laws from around the, not just around the country, but around the world, and talking about how to beat the challenges used under the originalism, the text history and tradition test. And so they have a list of all the cases that are pending in the Supreme Court, and it's about a dozen cases long. The primary ones, I think, are Rogers v. Grewal, which is the New Jersey May issue challenge to public carry, and probably Warman. That's the ban on assault, on so-called assault weapons and large cap mags. I think those are the two cases that are being supported by NRA that are now pending review for cert. But there's a number other there. There's a number up there with lesser issues. There's a bump stock, a challenge to the bump stock ban.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that's getting cert. There's a federal ban on out-of-state handgun purchases. That might have a chance because it's such a smaller issue and it's more related to interstate commerce. I just don't see many others that really stand a real good chance. The Cheeseman v. Polito, that's a New Jersey May issue,
mm-hmm.
public carry case, but I think there's a better one that they would like over that. And remember, they shot based on the lawyers, too. So Clement is the lawyer for, I want to say, Warman.
Okay.
They want, you know, Paul Clement is the one, is the lawyer, former Solicitor General of the United States, who
mm-hmm.
Argued for the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association on Monday. And he's argued 98 cases in front of the United States Supreme Court. So they know him, they respect him. They consider him an advocate as opposed to an activist.
Mm-hmm.
They're very nervous about people who are activists. So there's a lot of what cases the Supreme Court actually decides to hear is based on who the lawyer is that's handling it. So the cases that he's the lawyer on have a much better chance of being accepted.
Interesting.
And the NRA uses him. The NRA uses him for all the cases.
And you know what's fascinating to me, Chuck, is that you know with all of these efforts by gun control activists to avoid judicial scrutiny, it could be that they end up with a worse case because you know from their perspective, this is a case. The New York City case deals with the transporting of firearms. It does not deal specifically with the carrying of firearms, but Rogers versus Grewal does deal with the carrying of firearms and the May issue or the good cause requirements that, as you noted earlier, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit struck down in Washington, D.C. The same types of laws that are being challenged by yourself and others in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now. And the court could pluck that New Jersey case up and say, all right, you know, we're going to skip arguing about whether or not you can transport a firearm. We're just going to go straight to the argument about whether or not the right to bear arms means anything.
That's right, the right to bear arms in public for self-defense. And that's the gamble that the city of New York took by mooting this case. Because the question now becomes, okay, if they're going to declare the New York City case as moot, then they don't have, the New York City case was sort of a baby step case.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't full-on bear, the right to bear for self-defense. It was the right to transport to use in different places where you keep a firearm. So Now the question is the Supreme Court going to be frustrated, angry with the fact that the New York City went so far to try and loot this baby step case, and will they then take a case that goes a little farther? And one of these carry cases is sort of the natural place to go from here. Now that this smaller issue of whether or not to transport from your house to a range is protected, it may not be on the table if they decide it's moot. Which is also, by the way, a reason for the court for the judges to want to have the case not be moot, mm-hmm. because they don't want to have to get into the colon and carry debate yet. So this is where you really have to try and read people's minds. I know Thomas wants to take a carry case. You know, he's not looking for baby steps.
Right.
I think that's probably true of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh too.
What about Alito?
But I think he's almost there. He's dissented against some of the denials of some of the other cases.
Yeah.
So he may be there. So again, it comes back to Roberts and him trying to be this great leader of the Supreme Court and sort of not take the case of Kennedy. He'll never be that left or that moderate. But he's still, you know, you see what he did in the Obamacare case and some of the other cases where he's kind of making himself out to be the thoughtful swing vote. And so it's very interesting. You know, I mean, what comes next after this? There's so many different ways it can go, but sooner or later, as I said, one of these cases, and I think it's sooner, they're going to take a case, they're going to set the standard of review, they're going to change the standard of review from what the lower courts have been pushing, because that just gives the lower courts the excuse to uphold everything. And laws are, gun control laws are going to become vulnerable to Second Amendment challenges. And that's when, really, it's the time for, the folks that have experience on these cases, Clement and Holbrook and my firm and some of the other firms that have done this, to really step up and, litigate these cases carefully, thoughtfully, with the resources you need. You know, you just, unfortunately, there's a lot of lawyers, but many of them don't really have the writing ability or the time and resources. I mean, if you're going to take a case to the Supreme Court, you've got to spend about 4 months solid, pretty much working on preparing that case. Unless you've done it 100 times, then it gets a little easier, but you can't, it's just not, and it, unfortunately, there's just a shortage of persuasive writing ability out there among a lot of lawyers. And that's what it really takes to win a case. And not just that, but also obviously prepare the complaint, try and plan ahead for ways that the other side and possible courts might distort things to take a case away from you. I mean, it's just, it's not easy.
I tell you what, next time, we're running out of time here, but next time we have you on, let's talk about the future of, I guess, Second Amendment litigation from that standpoint, because, you know, you mentioned the Duke University firearm section at Duke Law. You've also got the Every Town has its own litigation firm. The gun control groups are getting very, very serious about putting their resources into these legal arguments. And I'd love to talk to you about the other side of that equation, what gun owners and Second Amendment supporters are doing. So will you come back soon so we can talk about that?
Of course. Love to.
Excellent. Chuck Michelle, president of the California Rifle and Pistol Association, Second Amendment attorney, civil rights attorney out in California. Thank you, as always, sir. It's great talking to you today. All right. So we will continue to keep our eyes on the court. But again, no new cases taken in Friday's conference. That doesn't guarantee that the court is going to issue an opinion in the New York City case. But it is worth noting that we don't have any new Second Amendment cases that the court has agreed to take. We'll keep our eyes on this week's conference, and we'll give you an update when we know any more. Let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Recidivist report today from Alabama, where the man charged with the murder of a Huntsville, Alabama police officer, previously charged with assaulting an officer, as well as other charges, as it turns out, 41-year-old LeJeremy Brown, no stranger to law enforcement. According to WAAY, Channel 31 in Alabama, they say, according to federal court records, he was indicted in the Eastern District of Tennessee on 5 drug-related charges back in 2013. Sentenced in 2015, after he pleaded guilty to the charge of conspiracy to distribute cocaine and crack cocaine. 4 other charges dropped as a result of that guilty plea. He was sentenced to 41 months in federal prison and 2 years of supervised release. That release period set to end in October of 2018. But before that release date ended and he was, you know, off of probation, he ended up getting arrested 2 more times, 2 more felony charges, one in Laredo, Texas, the other in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was the mile 29 marker on Highway 35 north of Laredo, Texas. He was pulled over, and this was in, believe, 2018, and Border Patrol agents located a 6-hour pistol with a load of magazine and 1 round in the chamber in his vehicle, which, as a convicted felon, the Jeremy Brown, not allowed to possess. The U.S. probation officer, Kimberly Williams, said that for most of his supervised release, his only violations had been leaving the district without permission, missing 2 random drug tests. But because of the prior conviction and because of this arrest, she suggested that he be detained until his revocation hearing. And then on June 20th of 2018, federal prosecutors filed a motion to dismiss the superseding indictment, and the case was dropped for some reason. Don't know why. Again, he was found with a gun in the car, but federal prosecutors dropped that case. A couple months later, another federal warrant issued for LeJeremy Brown, this time involving a violent home invasion in Chattanooga, Tennessee. August 15th, 2018, according to court records, he and another man, or other men rather, confronted a woman on her front porch while armed. Victim told officers that the suspect yelled Chattanooga police while pointing guns at her. They brought her inside, put her on the couch. They handcuffed her. They then put blankets over her head and the head of her children while they ransacked the house. They reportedly stole the victim's television, Xbox, a phone, and then her car. There was a high-speed chase that ended when the vehicle that Brown was in crashed into some train tracks. A U.S. probation officer argued that based on the nature of the new criminal conduct, the office considers Mr. Brown to be a danger to the community and a flight risk, so let's hold him behind bars until his revocation, probation revocation hearing. In a hearing on December 18th of 2018, court records show the victim of the robbery would not testify against Brown, and the state of Tennessee had elected to dismiss the home invasion robbery charge against him. Federal prosecutors followed suit. They dismissed its warrant for offender under the Supervision Act, and at that point, he was released from custody. Yeah. December 21st, shortly thereafter, he was arrested on multiple charges in Hamilton County, Tennessee, felony evading arrest, aggravated assault on a police officer. He was released on $50,000 bond, and the case was bound over for a grand jury. And again, no word on why prosecutors in that case didn't try to revoke his probation. But Brown right now in the Madison County Jail on a capital murder charge. It's unclear when he'll make his first court appearance, but it is abundantly clear that there were opportunities to put him behind bars. Now, if a witness won't cooperate, if a witness won't testify, that's one thing. But I still want to know more about that arrest in Laredo, Texas, and why prosecutors dropped the case after discovering a gun in his car. Let's get to today's armed citizen story from Tyler, Texas. KLTV reporting that a sex assault suspect held at gunpoint by an armed citizen after the man allegedly assaulted his daughter, 33-year-old Ronald Brent Hunt. Now charged with sexual assault of a child, he was arrested on November the 30th. He's being held on $1 million bond. According to an affidavit provided to KLTV on Thursday of last week, police were dispatched to an address in Tyler after gunshots were heard in the area, and a man called 911 saying that a gentleman was pointing a gun at another individual. Officers arrived. They spoke with the homeowners. They said that they had left their daughter home alone for the evening while they went out to dinner, and when they returned home, they heard somebody leaving the home from a side door, which is connected to the daughter's room. Homeowner said that he confronted the man, later identified as Hunt, and a physical altercation occurred, which involved the discharging of a gun. Police spoke to Hunt after he was detained in the back seat of a police car. According to the affidavit, Hunt admitted to having sex with the girl. Again, now facing felony sexual assault of a child charges. The armed citizen who held Hunt at gunpoint until police arrived, not facing any charges. Probably, I'm guessing, maybe in line for a award there in Tyler, Texas. Finally, our good deed of the day from Madison, Illinois, KPLR in St. Louis, on the story of a Good Samaritan who woke up three individuals from their home in Madison, Illinois, early this morning and alerted them to the fact that their house was on fire. Thankfully, because of the quick action of the Good Samaritans, all of the individuals inside that home were able to escape unharmed. Cause of the fire is still being investigated, and it looks like the home may be a total loss. It is one thing to have to rebuild your life after you have lost, all of your possessions in a house fire. But I can tell you here locally, just this fall, we have had two fatal house fires. We had a family that died, mom, dad, and their son died in a house fire. And we had a woman die in a house fire just a couple of weeks later. And, you know, as awful as it is to lose your stuff, it is just an absolute horrific tragedy to when folks lose their life in these blazes. So thankfully, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, we thank that anonymous Good Samaritan for their very good deed. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I do appreciate you being a part of the program. As I mentioned, I will be in Buckingham County, Virginia this evening. If you are in the area, you feel like going to the Board of Supervisors meeting, there you go. Monday, December 9th, 6 p.m. That's a signboard, one of the local convenience stores, alerting the population, hey, show up and defend your gun rights. We'll talk more about that on tomorrow's Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. But in the meantime, thanks again for being a part of today's program. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the show as a podcast at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and townhall.com's podcast page. Also, don't forget, you can become a VIP member of Bearing Arms, get exclusive content and commentary, editors' chats, and more. You can do that at bearingarms.com. Have a great rest of your Monday. And we will see you here soon with a brand new edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company.